Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Ralph Baxter, Chairman and CEO of ORIC, and it is a pleasure to welcome all of you here tonight and on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. Tonight is the third in our series, our speaker series we call the AHA Speaker Series. This is a speaker series that we are doing in partnership between ORIC and the Commonwealth Club, and it is our goal to present to our community here in San Francisco speakers from around the world who will share ideas and thoughts with us that will be provocative enough that we might just say aha to one or more of them. I think we've done pretty well so far. We had Paul Krugman, the great economist and columnist from the New York Times, and I think we had aha moments that evening, and Mohamed Yunus, the Nobel Prize-winning pioneer in microfinance, and I know we had such moments that evening, and I think we're about to have some more. Tonight, we have one of the most creative and thoughtful observers of the events, the economic, social, and political events that are shaping our times, Fareed Zakaria. Fareed really is a thoughtful observer, and he finds a remarkable array of media in which to express his ideas. Fareed is editor-in-chief of Newsweek International, a position he's held since 2000, and a publication that now reaches 24 million readers. He's also a regular columnist in Newsweek International and in The Washington Post. He is a regular panelist on ABC's This Week with George Stephanopoulos. And this Sunday, he begins a new television program, which he will host on CNN called GPS for Global Public Square. And his first guest will be Tony Blair. Mr. Zakaria is also an author. He's written a number of books, including the best-selling The Future of Freedom, Illiberal Democracy at Home and Abroad, which has now been translated into 20 languages. And his most recent book, which is itself already a bestseller, and I know that firsthand. Yesterday I went to try to buy a copy at Barnes & Noble, and I was too late. They are all gone. Is a very informative look at this changing world of ours, the role the United States has played in causing many of these changes, and the role that we, the United States, will have in that changed world. Mr. Zakaria begins his new book with the observation, "This is not a book about the decline of America, but rather the rise of everyone else." And as he said to us before we began tonight, this really is an optimistic look at the world ahead. Ladies and gentlemen, Fareed Zakaria.
Thank you so much. It's such a pleasure to be in San Francisco, especially with weather like this. It's a great pleasure to be back. I thought I'd tell you a little bit about this book and how it came into being. I began to think about it, I think, a few years ago, when I was in a taxi in Singapore. I was in this taxi, and the driver is showing me around between one appointment to the next, and he points out that there in the background is a large Ferris wheel that had just been built. And I said, I suppose in a slightly patronizing manner, I said, "Oh, how wonderful, you have a Ferris wheel in Singapore." And he turned around and he said to me, "Sir, that's the largest Ferris wheel in the world." And then I was in a mall in Beijing, the South China Mall in Beijing, and the guy taking me around explaining to me how big it is, and finally points out that it is the largest mall in the world. And I thought to myself, that can't be true, because I've been to the Mall of the Americas in Minneapolis, and it says on it that it's the largest mall in the world. So I went back. I didn't say anything at this point. I had learned my lesson. I went back to the hotel room and did the kind of careful and thoughtful research that journalists are famous for. I Googled a fair amount. And I discovered that while I had been sleeping, the Mall of the Americas had been taken over, and today it does not even make the top 10. And so I started looking around, and I realized that the largest publicly traded corporation in the world is now in Beijing. The largest refinery in the world is being built in India. The richest man in the world, most weeks, depending on the stock market, is in Mexico City. The other weeks is in Omaha, Nebraska. I was in India and I was looking at the Times of India's advertising, and it said the largest English language newspaper in the world. And again, I thought to myself, I remember distinctly seeing that about USA Today. And again, it was true, but no longer. So I thought to myself, well, you know, what do we have left? We don't even have shopping left, right? I mean, even the malls have been globalized. And I was in Las Vegas. And I thought to myself, well, this we have, the biggest, baddest sin city of all. And it turns out, of course, that Macau last year overtook Las Vegas in total gambling revenues. And the Venetian in Macau is not just the largest casino in the world, but it is three times larger than any casino in Las Vegas. So welcome to the post-American world. The point I was trying to make in that title is precisely that the United States remains a powerful country, remains a very important country, but that the extraordinary position it has held as the pivot of the world, the center of the world, the originator of every trend in the world, and the shaper of the future is now giving way to a world in which the future is being shaped in many places by many people. If you think about what is going on in the world and you want to put a number to it, this is the one number I'd ask you to keep in mind. In 2006 and in 2007, 124 countries around the world grew at 4% a year or more. Now, that number is unprecedented. If you'd gone back 30 years ago and asked how many countries were growing at 4%, it would have been 30, 35, a small number. And if you look geographically at where this is happening, the answer is everywhere. It's happening in Latin America. It's happening in Asia, of course. It's happening in the area around Eastern Europe and what is used to be called the stands. It is also happening in Africa. Last year, 30 countries in Africa grew at over 4% a year. That's two-thirds of the continent, comprising two-thirds of its people. So the world is changing, and we're not completely aware of it. You know, if you look around, you don't get the sense in the United States that we have fully understood this seismic shift that's taking place around the world. In a sense, you can see it in the extraordinary political stability you see around the world. I mean, there was a time when you had coups and counter-coups, and these derailed not just politics but economics. What's striking about the last few decade and a half, really, is that you've had occasional crises, you've had political problems, but they don't really cause the kind of wrenching dislocations politically or economically that you'd seen. I mean, this was vividly brought home to me when about 2 years ago, the United States, Israel went to war with Hezbollah in Lebanon. You remember that summer, I think it was July of 2006. And it was a very tough period. Rockets, missiles exchanging on both sides. I called up a friend of mine who worked in Israel in the economics ministry a couple of days after the war ended. And I said to him, how's it going? Just calling to inquire. And he was rattled. He was very rattled by the intensity of it all. And he was quite frankly scared. He said, these rockets reached further than we thought they could ever reach. The Israeli military response was really not that powerful. Hezbollah launched as many rockets on the last day of the war as on the first day of the war. And he was describing this and, going on in some detail, and I decided at some point to try and change the topic. probably somewhat inelegantly, you know, sort of like that line. Aside from that, Mrs. Lincoln, how did you enjoy the play? I think I said something like, oh, that's all great, Stan. Now, how's your day job? How's the economy going? And he says to me, this was the puzzle. He said, we were called in by the cabinet to brief them on the effects of the war the day it began. We all got it wrong. Last night, 2 days after the war, the Israeli stock market was higher than the day the war began. The shekel, Israel's currency, was higher than the day the war began. And this is actually part of a trend over the last 10 years. If you look at, you know, political news on the front pages of the newspaper, always seem, it seems to be bad. You know, there's an IED going off somewhere, a bomb going off somewhere, a rogue regime doing something nasty or the other. But then you'd look at the business pages, and it seemed as though the economies of the world were doing just fine. The market was not affected by these political turbulences. And I tried to figure out why this was happening. And one of the reasons I realized was, of course, and I hesitate to say this given that I'm beginning a show on CNN, but I realized that you just can't believe what you see on television. You know? I mean, you hear all this, you're surrounded by all this turbulence, this drama, but in point of fact, the data are very clear in that it shows that there has been a decline in major wars for the last 30 years. We may actually be living at a 50 or 70-year low point in terms of conflict. If you think about it, right, in the 70s you had the Indochina conflict, 3 million people dead. In the 80s, you had the Iran-Iraq war, at least 1 million people dead. In the early 90s, you had the civil war in Congo, about 4 million people dead. There's nothing quite like that on that scale taking place today. More importantly, I think, than just the reality that the combination of an information revolution with a disaggregated and competitive news media means there is a kind of tendency to exaggerate. And it's not just true of news networks. If you watch the Weather Channel, you will notice there's never a minor disturbance. It's always a storm of the century, hurricane of the millennia, just after the next commercial, you know. And I think that's part of what we will have to get used to in terms of processing this kind of information. But a broader part here is just if you look back in history, in the 1890s, 1900s, 1950s, early 1960s, these are periods when you had lots of political turbulence. The 1950s, think of it, the beginning of the Cold War. We thought we were going to go to war with Soviet Russia, then with China. Then you have the Suez Crisis, a series of crises in Africa. Then the Bay of Pigs in the early 60s, then Vietnam. Economy grows beautifully, right? Why is this happening? Because you have new entrance into the world economy, new players coming in who changed the size and scale of the global economy. It was in the 1890s, it was the United States and Germany industrializing to become great economic powers. In the 1950s, it's Europe rebuilding from the ashes of World War II, and Japan, which grew at 9% a year for 24 years, which was the first non-Western country to achieve anything like that kind of growth. Well, right now, we're going through the biggest expansion of the global economy in human history. You know, you have somewhere between 2 and 3 billion people coming online. And it's happening all over the world, and it's happening because of the confluence of all kinds of political, economic, and technological trends. The collapse of communism, the discrediting of central planning, the rise of free capital markets, sending money around the world, punishing and rewarding good and bad behavior. A broadband revolution that has connected the world together. All these things that I described have just happened in the last 15 years, really. And they're acting simultaneously to produce a global economy that is much, much more demanding at some level, but rewarding at another. If you play by the rules, in some sense, you do get rewarded. And that is why you're seeing countries around the world being rewarded. I mean, the Dominican Republic last year grew at 8%. Costa Rica is booming. Brazil, for the first time in its history, has an inflation rate the same as the United States. South Africa is growing at 5% a year. Eastern Europe has been booming. You know, and you go anywhere, you see this. And what's striking to me is just not the economic data, but it's the shift that it's producing kind of politically, culturally, psychologically. You know, one of the things I notice is that there is a much greater sense of confidence and pride around the world, confidence in their own story, their own narrative. We spend a lot of time here, when we think about the world at all, thinking about the problem of anti-Americanism, right? Which is a typically American response to thinking about the world, which is to say, let's stop talking about me. Now, what do you think of me? Right? It's and there's one side of the aisle which says, you know, this is a deep problem. We have to seduce the world back. We need to get our reputation back. There's another part of it that says, no, don't worry about it. They just hate us and they're envious because we're powerful and they're all vaguely French anyway. So, you know, discount it all. But what I'm struck by is that the world, while we're having this fascinating debate about anti-Americanism, it's kind of moved to a post-American phase where they're actually moving on, far more interested in what's going on in their countries, in their lands, and in other places around them. You know, I felt this vividly because when I was in college in the United States, I would go back to India where I grew up, and people were fascinated by America. And they were fascinated, I have to say, not by the grand machinations in Washington and, you know, whether George Shultz was winning in those days, this was the 1980s, over Caspar Weinberger and the battles within the Reagan administration, or the great intellectuals in Cambridge. They would ask me about Donald Trump. Donald Trump fascinated people. I mean, he was the kind of biggest, baddest, the brashest figure you could imagine, and of course you'd expect to find him in America. There's much less interest, in fact, almost no interest in figures like that in India today. And I was trying to figure it out and realized one day when I saw published one of these rich lists, you know, the list of the richest Indians, and I realized that there are now probably about 30 people in India who are richer than Donald Trump. So India has its own vulgar real estate billionaires to obsess about. You know, they don't need ours. And that, in a sense, is the story of what's changed psychologically. There's far more interest and awareness in the kind of indigenous sources of dynamism and growth and what it means. And it does change the narrative. It does change the way in which the world works in this sense. You know, when I was growing up in India, if you wanted to find out what the kind of global narrative, what was the agenda, what were the issues that one had to be thinking about, you would listen to the BBC, or you would read the Time or Newsweek, the International Herald Tribune, the Times of London. Those were your ways of looking up from outside your own parochial issues, because no Indian newspaper or magazine had anything like the resources to provide any kind of coverage of what was going on outside India. Maybe in Pakistan and China, that would be it. If you now look around the world, what you're struck by is the multiplicity of methods and vehicles and platforms of delivering news. So that, you know, you go to the Arab world and there's Al Jazeera and Al Arabiya and Al Hurra. You go to India, which is now extraordinary. It has 18 all-news channels, 18, five in English alone. You go to Latin America, and they now have all Spanish channels that span the entire continent. And all of these are well-equipped to be world-class in terms of technology, in terms of resources, and as a result, are able to provide a kind of different view of the world, a view, however, rooted in, Buenos Aires, or in New Delhi, or in Cairo. It's not that, you know, this. I'm not making a postmodern point that there is no truth and, you know, that this is all relative, but where you stand very powerfully affects how you see the world. I mean, I've always been struck by the difference between the way in which the Russians perceive World War II and Americans perceive World War II. You know, I mean, in America, the narrative of World War II is this heroic struggle in which the United States, with a little bit of help from Britain, you know, fights fascism, defeats Hitler, conquers a continent, and the great dramatic moment is, of course, the Normandy landings when the army lands in Europe and moves towards Berlin, interrupted by the Battle of the Bulge, but finally arrives at Berlin and conquers Germany. Right? For the Russians, this is all actually a sideshow. They will point out that 75% of German forces were engaged on the Eastern Front, and that 75% of Nazi casualties were on the Eastern Front, that the real battle that took place was a battle between the Wehrmacht and the Red Army, and you know all the rest of it was actually minor stuff. Now, that isn't, shall we say, how Stephen Ambrose thinks about it when he writes those wonderful accounts of World War II and when Ken Burns does his documentaries. I'll give you one example. You know, the 1943 is seen as a pivotal turning point in one of Ambrose's books. And he talks about the pivot, which is the Battle of Sicily. Now, the Battle of Sicily is an important battle. It engaged 65,000 German troops. But virtually simultaneously was taking place the Battle of Kursk, which engaged 1.65 million troops. Now, you can imagine why the Russians would tend to think that one was more important. But it doesn't get a line in Ambrose's book, and you will search in vain in the hours and hours of Ken Burns's documentary to find anything on it. And that's just one example of how differently people look at the world. I mean, I give you a more recent example. I was talking to a Chinese diplomat, and sort of you know, a friend of mine, and berating him. This is a younger guy in his 40s, berating him over China's association with Sudan because of Darfur. I was saying, you know, you guys are allied with a brutal dictatorship just for the oil. And he said to me, you're right, and we should be more sensitive to that issue. And he paused and then said, of course, you are allied with a medieval monarchy in Saudi Arabia because of the oil. And it really did occur to me that when we make these pronouncements, we don't really think back on how we are perceived by other people. You know, as an Indian diplomat told me when we were talking about Burma, and I was berating him for not being tougher on Burma, he said, look, it's right on our border. We have millions of refugees to worry about. The place is a pretty unstable mixture of ethnicities. And I said, fine. He said, look, you guys go around preaching the idea of democracy for the Muslim world, right? But then when we look at it, we notice that the three most important countries in terms of producing terrorism, which is Saudi Arabia, Egypt, and Pakistan, you very aggressively and wholeheartedly support military dictatorships or a royal family, right? And when we say anything about this, you say, well, those are exceptions. And what this diplomat said to me, he said, the question I have often when listening to the United States is, how come you get to have your exceptions, but we don't get to have ours? You know, and in a sense, that is one of the things that I think a lot of people around the world are now becoming more confident, articulate, and poised to talk about. Now, the real kind of problems we face are the intersection of this rise of the rest with a growing tide of something that comes along with it. Because as you grow, you have greater strength and pride and confidence, you also tend to get somewhat more nationalistic. And this is something you see in China, you see it in Russia, you see it in Brazil, you see it everywhere. You know, it's economic growth tends to make people feel pretty good about themselves. Just look at the United States, right? I'm sure that some of our confidence has something to do with our ideals, but some of it also has to do with the fact that this has been a great success story. Well, other countries are having success stories as well, and they're getting proud and confident. So we will have to figure out how, in a world like that, you solve problems. And while what I described is a world in which everyone is rising, and it may sound as though that doesn't mean a world of problems, far from it. Because if you look around, you realize there are lots of problems that we are beginning to encounter and will encounter more of. They are just problems in a sense of growth, problems, the consequences of 124 countries around the world growing at the same time. The first one that you can look at is the shortages of almost everything that we consume in the world, right? Oil is at $125 a barrel, roughly, but it's not just oil. Every commodity is at a 200-year high. If you look around at almost anything that we use that is dug up from the ground or produced, in agricultural terms, it is at a 200-year high. Food prices are rising everywhere in the world. My favorite example of this is, you know, helium, which is the gas used in balloons, but also, more importantly, in MRI machines, is in acute shortage. Helium is the second most abundant element in the universe. So if we're running out of helium, we have a real problem. If you look at what's happening with water, the top 10 cities in China are going to have acute water shortages in the next 10 years.
and so on. You know, so this is going to be a huge stress and strain on all of us, and how we manage it is going to be one of the chief challenges we face, and many of the conflicts, I would argue, that we were likely to see are going to come out of these problems of growth. Sometimes it happens in the most unlikely way. You know, we look at Darfur, and we think this is a genocide, and there's one bad group against another group of victims. And basically, that's true. But if you step one step back and say, why is it happening? What is clear in the Sudan, in the Western Sudan, is that the amount of arable land in the Western Sudan is drying up because of limited water, which is being used more and more, and perhaps exacerbated by global warming. The result is that there was a settled farming population which is now being driven off the land by a kind of nomadic warrior tribe, the Janjaweed, are the kind of lead element within it. So, and it's not to say that that they are right in doing it, but to point out that if you have such shortage, then human beings have moved and fought for 5,000 years over the supply of fresh water. So what you're seeing in Darfur may not be an isolated incident. It may be a harbinger of what's to come. If water supplies become more and more scarce around the world, you will have competitions, and probably they will take this form. The settled farmers will be attacked in some form or the other by kind of wandering groups that are losing the ability to make any kind of living, and therefore want this arable land, this dwindling supply of arable land. It's only one of the possibilities, but they are all related in some way or the other to this extraordinary growth that's taking place. The most striking of these, of course, is climate change. If you look around and you ask yourself, how are we going to deal with this problem? And, you know, we have tended to take the position in the West that, well, we need to use energy more efficiently, we need to be more conservation-minded. When I say we, I mean the educated citizenry. I do not mean our government currently. there was attempts to have a Kyoto Treaty deal with this. But in a strange sense, even Kyoto is a kind of backward-looking document, because it goes to the Western countries, because these are the richest, most powerful countries in the world, which have the biggest imprint on the world in terms of CO2 emissions, and says, let's come up with a template, let's solve this problem, and then we'll get the rest of the world to join in. That's, after all, how things have been done for the last 70 or so years. It's how trade deals are done. The West comes together, fixes on some formula, some standard, and you kind of go ahead. There's only one problem. If you look at what the reality is in terms of what's going to happen in CO2 emission, India and China are producing a coal-fired power plant every week. Every week they put one more online. The combined CO2 emissions from the 850 new coal-fired power plants that India and China are putting on between now and 2012 is five times the total savings of the Kyoto Accords. So you can put all those curly light bulbs in and drive all the Priuses you want. You know, and India just ate that for breakfast, and China will eat the next round of conservation for lunch. Unless you deal with Indian and Chinese coal, you're not touching the problem of global warming. That's 80% of the problem, because that's 80% of the new emissions. And we have a fascinating problem here, because when you go to the Indians and the Chinese, they say, yeah, but 80% of the old stuff, the stuff that's up there in the atmosphere, was produced by you. And we say, yeah, but 80% of the new stuff is going to be produced by you. Well, it seems to me this is precisely the moment at which you start needing to think about how do we solve these problems in an interdependent world. And what we are going to have to figure out is how to make this work together. You know, we're going to have to come together, preferably talk to the Indians and Chinese first, get them on board. I'm sure the Norwegians will follow. You know, I think that we should really try and figure out where is the most important sort of part of this problem. And if we can do that, then we will begin to come up with some solution. And look, the only solution that is likely to work with regard to this the issue of global warming is going to be some kind of subsidies for clean technologies in India and China. These are still poor developing countries. They are not going to voluntarily impose enormous costs on their development to go clean, to go green. And so there will have to be some kind of transfer of resources. Each of these, and by the way, the cost would not be ruinous to the Western world. Each of these problems has solutions. The question is, can we get ourselves into a frame of mind of recognizing that we have to do this together? We have to figure out what mechanisms, what methods to do it in, and move forward. You know, let me talk finally about the issue of how America fits into all this. A friend of mine once said to me, he's a preacher who really knows how to hold an audience's attention. He said, about in the middle of your speech, so look very carefully at the audience and say in a loud voice, in conclusion, it wakes them right up. but I am actually, this is the last set of remarks I want to make. You know, one of the big challenges that the United States faces going forward is asking ourselves, how do we look at this new world? Do we look at it with openness and embrace it, or do we look at it and fear it and kind of close down and hunker down? And that basic orientation is going to have a great deal to do with whether we succeed or fail in a post-American world. Because if you think about it, the United States has enormous assets. If you look around at the world I'm describing, it's already here. It's been here for 10, 15 years, and the United States has been thriving. Its companies have been able to take advantage of these trends in globalization and technology. Its universities have dominated the world. If you look at the industries of the future, nanotechnology, biotechnology, the United States is doing fantastically. The World Economic Forum puts out a global competitiveness report where they actually rank countries quite rigorously and ask, you know, which countries are doing well. And the overall ranking, the world's most competitive country, is currently the United States. It was last year the United States. So this economy is extraordinarily flexible, adaptable. It's going through a very rough patch right now, but that's part of its strength, is that it is able to ride the roller coaster of change and adapt and adjust in ways that many industrial economies can't. You know, Japan went through began a recession now 15 years ago and has barely gotten out of it because it has not been able to let the companies that needed to go bust, reorganize the sector. So the American economy is extraordinary, I think. The American society is extraordinary. If you look around at the world, again, the advanced industrial world, what you see more than anything else, I mean, I think the European economy is actually quite productive, but the big problem they face is demographic decline. They just don't have enough workers. Italy in 5 years is going to look like Florida. Now, I don't mean that aesthetically. I mean, I think the Italians would be horrified at that prospect. I mean demographically, the ratio of workers to retirees, and then comes Germany, and then comes France. The United States alone in the industrialized world is going to have lots of young people. Why? Because we still take in immigrants. We have, you know, we take in 1 million legal immigrants a year. That's more than the rest of the world put together. And we are creating the first universal nation in the world. I mean, if you know, people from all castes, creeds, colors come here, they assimilate, they become Americans. The Europeans have so much difficulty doing that. The Japanese have so much difficulty doing that. So there's enormous strengths to the society. Look at the presidential election, right? You had a Mormon, a Catholic, an Italian-American, a black, a woman, Hispanic, all running for president. If Joe Lieberman had joined in the race, you'd have completed the gorgeous mosaic. The question I think we face is not one about our economy or our society. It's about our politics. I think American politics are sort of brain dead right now. And they are brain dead at a dangerous moment in our history, because just at the moment that the rest of the world is getting very good at our game, just at the moment at which the world is catching up, we have simply lost the ability to make the adjustments that we need to be able to make this economy more competitive, make this society more dynamic, and just solve the basic problems we face going forward. If you think about it, whether it's energy policy, whether it's our pension, Social Security, whether it's our health care, whether it's our immigration system, for the last 10 years, we have basically kicked the can down the road. We have not dealt with any of these problems. They have all gotten worse and more expensive to deal with as a consequence. And we have lost the ability in any way to inflict any short-term pain for long-term gain. You know, anyone knows in any aspect of life, you have to do that. Anyone who's ever tried to exercise knows this, that there is a short-term pain element which has to be done for. As a political system, we have completely lost that ability. And part of the reason is, I think, we have grown in Washington fat and dumb and happy and arrogant. You know, I mean, we believe as Americans that competition helps with everything. Everybody is bettered by competition. Well, the United States has had the field to itself for the last 20 years, and it has made us very smug and very arrogant. And what I'm struck by is American companies, by and large, get this new world I'm describing. American universities get it. Young people, I find, get it. They're living it, you know. Particularly for companies, they're living and dying by this world. Washington does not. It is still an imperial bubble where the thought is all roads lead to Washington, the world is still shaped here, and we still get to determine everything. And, you know, meanwhile, London has become the world's most important financial center, and we haven't really even noticed. We're just doing what we do. It's not that we've done anything terribly egregious. We've just sat around while they've gotten their act together. So if you think about it in foreign policy terms, again, you see a kind of smugness and arrogance and an unwillingness to get into the game and hustle the way everybody else is. We somehow expect that we will magically counter Iran's influence in the Middle East without ever talking to Syria, without ever talking to Hezbollah, to figure out whether there's a way to wean them off or divide them or split them, and without ever, of course, talking to the Iranians to figure out whether there are any deals to be had along the way. No, we sit in a state of pristine and virtue, unsullied by any contact with these people, while meanwhile, they run circles around us. If you look at what's going on in the Middle East, Hezbollah is dominant in Lebanon. Hamas is doing quite well in the Palestinian Authority. Iran and Syria are on the march. Meanwhile, we're not talking to dictators. Thank goodness, right? We're losing, but we're not talking to dictators. And it's that attitude that somehow we have to... And it's part of a broader shift that we have to try and achieve. The thing I worry about most, my final point, is that just as this world is opening up, we're closing down. The one poll I leave you with, the Pew survey, 47 countries done 9 months ago, they asked people around the world, what do you think of free trade? And thumping majorities everywhere said, it's a great idea. I mean, and this was striking to me because growing up in the third world, you know, the general thought was when I was growing up that free trade was a Western plot hatched by multinationals to come in and rape, pillage, and plunder the local economy, right? And yet you'd find 88% of Indians said free trade is a good idea, 92% of Chinese, 77% of Nigerians. The country that came in dead last, 47th out of 47, was the United States of America. And this is the thing that worries me more than anything else, that we, you know, and it's ironic because, of course, we were at the forefront of creating this world. For 60 years, American diplomats went around the world telling people, open your markets, open your politics, open yourselves up to the American vision of the world. American businessmen did it, American scholars did it, American journalists did it. And now it's happened, and we're thunderstruck. And I just hope, looking forward, you know, 200 years from now, when some historian writes the history of our times, they don't write that, you know, the United States actually succeeded in its great historical mission of opening up the world, of globalizing the world. It just forgot along the way to globalize itself. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
You can hear from the extent of the applause this evening how much resonance your remarks have with this audience. Our thanks to Fareed Zakaria, the editor of Newsweek International and author of The Post-American World, for his illuminating comments and the book upon which they are based. I'm Elizabeth Sherwood Randall. I'm a member of the Commonwealth Club's Board of Governors and a senior research scholar at Stanford University's Center for International Security and Cooperation. I have the privilege of conducting the audience portion of the program this evening. Fareed, as you can imagine, we have a huge number of questions that have been submitted. So we'll begin, and I just want to encourage the audience to listen for the gist of your question. There are so many, I'm going to try to group them. And while your words may not be spoken, I hope you will hear a response to your interests as we have this conversation with our brilliant speaker. Let's start with a quick trip around the world. because there have been questions about many of the countries that you touch on in your book and in your remarks tonight. First of all, about China. How soon, if ever, do you expect China's form of government to catch up with its capitalism? What is the likely prognosis for the future of China, and how will it affect the United States?
I think that the thing one has to remember about China is, first of all, this is a country that has had 4,000 years of continuous civilized existence and existence as a single political entity. So, you know, we should not approach China with the surety that we actually know exactly what we should do with them. This is a very old civilization that has, for many periods in history, been extremely successful. The second point I would make is, if you look at China from where it was when we made a decision to engage with them and to try to integrate them into the world, China has changed enormously. The China of Mao Zedong's era was ruled by a truly crazy government. I mean, this was a government. We talk about Ahmadinejad as being crazy because he's given a couple of off-color speeches in which he has said a few very nasty and offensive things. Mao was launching revolutions and insurgencies all over the world. He launched the Great Leap Forward, which killed 30 million Chinese. He sacrificed, God knows, 1 million people in the Korean War. He launched the Cultural Revolution, which destroyed the entire country. And he was constantly threatening, by the way, to blow up half the world once he got nuclear weapons. This country has gone from that, and from being quite literally one of the poorest five countries in the world, to a situation where it's not just rich, but it is much more open. You know, people have the ability to work, to live, to own property. These are all rights that Thomas Jefferson would understand as human rights. It has not yet opened up its politics. In my view, it is inconceivable that over time, as China's economy opens up more and more, you will not have a similar opening up of its politics. But that does not mean it will look like American democracy. You know, Japan is our favorite democracy in East Asia. Let me remind you, Japan has been a democracy for 60 years. Its ruling party has never lost power. I mean, we would not consider that in the United States a democracy, right? If the Republicans had been in power for nine elections, and somehow, you know, there was no press opposition to it. But, you know, so these countries have their own forms, but I'm convinced that if you look forward in China, it will get more open. But it's not going to happen on our timeline, you know. We wanted it to happen in the Olympics, by the Olympics, so we could have a guilt-free enjoyment of that. You know, I'm sorry, that's not the trajectory. The trajectory is this was one of the poorest countries in the world. Mostly these things tend to happen with middle-income countries. If you look at the historical record, when did Taiwan move from authoritarianism? When did South Korea move? You know, it will. In my view, it is impossible to run a society as open and dynamic, as flexible as China is becoming with a very harsh system. And you can see the difference, by the way, in the Chinese response to the earthquake and the Burmese response. The Chinese were far more responsive, far more attentive to the needs of their citizens than the Burmese were. So, you know, there is a distinction here, and there has been progress. Should there be more? Yes. But as I say, it'll happen on their timeline, not on ours.
Thank you. Let's move on to the Islamic world. A number of members of the audience are interested in knowing your view on what we need to do to repair our relations and avoid a clash of civilizations with Islam.
Well, I think the good news that I would give you is that I have never believed that there is a clash of civilizations. I've always believed that the real rift was a clash within a civilization, a battle within Islam between the extremists and the moderates. This is the most fundamental divide that exists there, and we were a kind of side player. We were in some ways implicated because of whom we were seen as supporting, that is, all these dictatorships and monarchies. But if you look at what's happening in the world of Islam over the last few years, I see some very encouraging signs. Al-Qaeda and its ilk, that is, radical Islamic violent movements, have seen a precipitous drop in their support over the last 5 years. In some cases, it's down 50% from what was never, you know, very high numbers. Now, why is this happening? Because
initially there may have been a sort of protest element to the support for these groups, you know, the sense of, you know, the way in which people supported Che Guevara or Black Power in the 1960s. After a while, you ask yourself, are they presenting you with a compelling vision of the world you want to live in? And none of these people are. I mean, Muslims by the millions flock every year to visit Dubai and the razzle-dazzle of Dubai, not the seminaries of Tehran. You know, they also want some kind of modernity. Sure, it's a culturally specific modernity, and they want it in some sense that is compatible with their own tradition. But nobody wants to live under the Taliban. And that reality, and the more assassinations and the more terrorism that takes place, the lower the support. So you see this, by the way, in Pakistan, where support for any kind of jihad has dropped 50 or 60% in the last 4 or 5 years. Why? Because there's been more terrorist attacks. It was easy to support jihad when they were killing Americans. But now they're killing locals. And you say to yourself, wait a minute, is this the kind of world I want to live in? And the other thing that's happening is the moderates are getting bolder and bolder. I invite you to read Benazir Bhutto's book, the book she wrote before she died. It's an extraordinarily brave denunciation of Islamic extremism, a very brave affirmation of a kind of liberal interpretation of Islam. And what I think is interesting about it is, you know, look at the way in which we pay attention to things. This is, without question, the most popular political figure in the world of Islam. She led the largest political party in the second largest Muslim country in the world. Yet her voice was somehow never seen as large enough compared with some crackpot mullah who somebody had, you know, heard on the internet, and then that goes around spiraling around and finds itself up on Fox TV, and you say, oh my God, they're going to kill us all because this late night, you know, a telly sheikh, as they call them in Britain, issued a fatwa. Again, think about where the big trends are going, and the big trends are going in the direction of moderates. So I am hopeful. There's still a problem because the ones who are extreme are truly evil and truly crazy, and we have to kill and catch and apprehend them. But the broader battle, which is really being waged within the Muslim world, is, in my opinion, going in a very positive direction, perhaps more slowly than I would like. But it certainly seems that the arrow is pointing in the right direction.
And a follow-up question. A number of members of the audience are interested in knowing what you would do about Iran.
I think the first thing I would do about Iran is put it in context. You know, Iran is 1/68th the GDP of the United States. Our defense budget is 110 times larger than theirs. So when you hear people talk about Iran as the new Soviet Union, you know, let's just remember, the Soviet Union actually had enough missiles to destroy the United States about 30 or 40 times over. Iran does not have one. So when we talk about building a missile shield in Eastern Europe and thereby angering the Russians and, you know, expending enormous resources, you know, we're constructing a system that doesn't work for a threat that doesn't quite exist yet. And that is our response to it. Remember now, we will soon be celebrating the 30th anniversary of the Star Wars missile shield that we were promised now 30 years ago. What I would really do is look at it this way. First of all, the Iranians are not crazy in having legitimate concerns about their security. They are surrounded by nuclear countries. India, China, Pakistan, and Israel, of course, all have nuclear weapons. And it is surrounded on each side of its border by American troops, 50,000 in NATO troops in Afghanistan and 150,000 in Iraq. And the President of the United States continuously says that this is a regime of deep evil that he wants to overthrow. Now, if you were in Tehran, and even if you weren't a crazy mullah, you might get a little nervous, right? And you might want to buy some insurance. And that insurance in the world of international politics is nuclear weapons. So this is not crazy. There are legitimate issues that have to be dealt with. On the other hand, I obviously think they shouldn't go nuclear, and I think we should make every effort to stop them. But I think the best effort we can make is to construct an alliance of states around Iran that will check and counter Iran's influence. Iran is going to do what it's going to do. We do not have the power, even including bombing, to stop the nuclear program. If they are determined to get nuclear weapons, We can delay that program with a bombing strike. We cannot end, we cannot end it because they will start rebuilding. Iran will have probably, by my rough estimate, $50 billion of surplus revenues this year because of the price of oil. So, you know, you bomb them, they have money to rebuild all those facilities. What we can do, however, is to take advantage of that reality of a rising Iran and get all the Arab states to remember why it might be a good idea to have an alliance with the United States, why it's nice to have friends. And in a strange way, the Arabs and Israel, for the first time, are on the same side of a strategic divide. So that the Arabs and the Israelis might find some common interests and some common ground. And so you build a kind of containment strategy against Iran, because at the end of the day, we can outlast them. If we don't get spooked, if we don't get paranoid and terrified by them, we've got to remember, you know, we have the answers to the modern world. The mullahs do not. And just as fascism and just as communism and just as all these the crackpot ideologies fail over time, it will fail. But if we spook ourselves into thinking these guys are 10 feet tall, we will overreact, we will do things that are stupid, we will build up their importance in the world in a way that's unnecessary. Build a containment strategy against them, stay calm, stay cool. Over time, time is on our side, not on the side of these decrepit old mullahs who are squirreling away money in their bank accounts in Switzerland and Dubai. You know, that to my mind, by the way, shows you that they are not millenarians who are looking for the end of days. You wouldn't open Swiss bank accounts if you were going to end the world. That seems like an awful lot of trouble to go through.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program with Newsweek International editor and author of The Post-American World, Fareed Zakaria. We're going to continue our trip around the globe and talk about India. You describe India in the book as a source of long-term stability. You describe India's democracy as a source of long-term stability, though you say it's a strong society with a weak state. And you also describe our own country as being paralyzed by its democratic politics. As we look around the world and recognize that we need new allies, is India a prospect for an expanded relationship that might contribute in a way that our relationships with our European allies contributed in the 20th century to advancing American goals?
I think there is a prospect in terms of the relationship between the United States and India for a similar relationship as has existed between some of our European allies. And I'll tell you why. Because first of all, there's an obvious match of strategic interests. The United States is concerned about the rise of China, not necessarily in a nefarious way, not in a way that we want to go to war with China, but the rise of China is upsetting and unsettling the balance of power in Asia without any question. This is, you know, the most important event taking place, single event taking place in the world. In that context, having a friend, having an ally in India, which is another large Asian country that is also concerned about the rise of China and wants to make sure that it does not end up living in an Asia totally dominated by China, makes perfect sense. And in that, you know, so there is a strategic alignment. But there's also something more. You know, I think American relationships are always strongest when they are not simply state to state, but society to society. If you think about the relationship between the United States and Britain and the United States and Israel, the big difference there, you know, the big similarity there is that they are really society-to-society relationships, so relationships that are cultural, economic, social, almost familial in some sense. Whereas if you look at the relationship between another of our core allies, the United States and Saudi Arabia, it's really a government-to-government relationship between 25 people on either end, in either capital, right? So what is enduring in some sense are these deeper relationships. And India, for all kinds of reasons, because of the Indian diaspora, because it's also, like the United States, a kind of big, messy, chaotic democracy, it feels very familiar to both sides. You know, I mean, I'm struck by this. When Americans look at a country like China or Iran, part of what scares us and spooks us is just the impenetrability of the political system. Like, who is actually making decisions? What is going on? What is the Politburo? Who is the Central Committee? What is the Guardian of Elders? The Council of Elders? Who are these people? You know, what's going on? Whereas, if you look at the Indian system, totally wide open, crazy democracy where, you know, you're trying to get anything done. People are, you know, every day six people are leaking six different stories to six different newspapers. You know, you can't, the minute the prime minister says something, somebody from the opposition party accuses, you know, him of treason. That we understand. That's Washington, you know. And in a sense, the two countries as a result have a kind of natural affinity. But I would say, don't make the mistake of thinking that India will end up being, you know, America's pawn in Asia. It's a big country. It's a proud country. It's a very prickly country. And it has its own interests. China has just overtaken the United States as India's largest trading partner. So while it is wary of China's rise, it also benefits enormously from it. And there's finally an Asian way of dealing with things, which is slightly different than a Western way. In the West, you know, you have something like NATO. It's a clear, clean alliance. We set out exactly what it's for. You know, it is to defend against the Soviet threat. And it was, everybody had to sign up. They had to contribute to it. It was affirmations regularly made at annual NATO meetings. In Asia, nobody will ever do that. If anyone's going to balance against China, they're all going to tell you China is their best friend. They're going to cooperate with China and simultaneously balance against it. There's going to be this very, you know, ambiguous situation where no one will admit to ever being, you know, opposed to somebody or for it. And you see that in Asian diplomacy. That nobody will ever criticize any other country, even while they're actively working to somehow undermine it. And we will have to get used to that. I don't think Asia is going to be remade and there will be an Asian NATO. There will instead be this very amorphous process of, you know, part balancing, part bandwagoning, maybe call it hedging. You know, every Asian country will engage in some kind of hedging strategy, and we'll have to live with that and understand it.
Thank you. We're going to turn to what might be considered domestic issues, although based on what you said, obviously whatever is local is global, and whatever is global is local. We have a number of members of the audience who are interested in knowing about immigration and its impact on the United States. You came to this country for education. Questions arise about whether in the future people will continue to seek to come and what American immigration policy is doing to deter the world from enriching us in the future.
Well, if you think about it, you know, you look at the things I was talking about as our core strengths, the nanotechnology, biotechnology, the universities, the fact that we do very well. Don't worry about all those stories you hear about Chinese and Indian engineers. Trust me, we train lots of very highly skilled engineers in this country. Per capita, actually, if you look at the data, I point this out in the book, we train more real engineers, four-year engineers, than China or India. But now, here's the cloud or the silver lining, depending on how you look at it. 50% of all PhDs given out in this country last year were given to foreigners. So number of science PhDs that will be awarded to foreign students in 5 years from now will be 75%. Three out of every four science PhDs in this country. That's who does it. That's who does the hard work, the lab work. Those are the people who want to do it. So we have one choice. Do we want them to stay here and the innovation stays here, or do we want them to go back and the innovation goes back? And there are now many, many more opportunities back home than there ever were before. There are research labs, there are universities, and there's the private sector, all of which offer very, very attractive opportunities. So what we have to ask ourselves is, you know, rather than this insane debate we've been having about how much we can humiliate and punish and stigmatize immigrants, we should be asking ourselves, what do we need to do to be attracting them and retaining them in a world in which, you know, this kind of talent is now extremely marketable? And in case you don't think, you know, the rest of the world has caught on, just as I say, as the world is opening up, we're closing down. So the Europeans have instituted something called, with enormous creativity, the blue card. The blue card is a permanent residency in Europe which allows people to live there and work there forever. And it is entirely designed basically to attract Indian software engineers, Chinese scientists, and things like that. So now they can not only go back home, but they can go to Europe. This is, I think, going to be a huge problem we face going forward because we are changing in that respect. I mean, there's still enough people out there that will attract people, but we used to get the first draft picks of the world. And the question is, are you still going to get those people? Or are they going to be going to be looking around? Because, you know, if people feel that they're going to be hassled, if there's a huge, if it's impossible to get the H-1 visa, if their parents are going to have to be frisked for 4 hours at JFK every time they come, you know, these things actually contribute substantially to an image of a country that is not as welcoming. I remember coming here in the 80s, and the amazing thing was just how wide open the country was, how, in a sense, nobody really cared whether you were an immigrant or what. Now, you know, I defensively say I'm a legal immigrant. You know, there's a sense in which you have to qualify that to make it clear. And let me end by saying one sort of, you know, probably politically dangerous point, but even people who come here, however they come here, this country has benefited enormously from the extraordinary talent and energy and hard work of people who are willing to risk their lives to come here to wash your dishes, look after your kids, water your lawn, you know, do the kind of construction work and pick fruits in 120-degree temperatures that nobody else wants to do. It is what has kept this country alone among the industrial world, vibrant and hungry in a way that it has still wanted to succeed. It has still sought that kind of success. And I think, however they came here, to be demonizing these extremely poor people who have, you know, risked everything to do what? To come here and work is, again, sending a very, very bad message about what America is about.
So, Fareed, I cannot avoid this any longer. We have many questions on one subject, and it is a domestic issue with foreign policy implications. Everyone in this audience wants to know which of the candidates has a view of the world that most closely resembles the prescriptions in your book.
Yeah. All right. Well, I'll tell you, I'll tip my hand by pointing out that last week, Senator Obama was photographed at an airport in Montana, I think it was, with a copy of my book and his finger dead center in the middle of it. Look, I'll tell you, I have an enormous amount of respect for John McCain. He's been both personally and politically an enormously brave man and politician. I'm puzzled by what has happened to him over the last few years, because he seems to have really adopted this kind of neoconservative worldview where, you know, he gave a speech a few months ago where he was talking about kicking Russia out of the G8, expanding the G8 to pointedly exclude China, setting up a league of democracies that would consciously exclude all the non-democracies in the world. It does feel like it is an attempt to create new battle lines in the world and to kind of restart a Cold War, this time with China and Russia and apparently all these autocracies, by the way, which include Saudi Arabia and all the countries that give us oil and that we need, you know, on the Iranian front. And I think that there's just something about that that suggests a kind of fondness for the kind of Cold War and the stirring of the Cold War, and really doesn't get this new world we're in. I think Obama seems to get it much more, with one big caveat. I don't think that if Mr. Senator Obama thinks that the world is going to sing hallelujah when he gets elected, if he continues to talk about trade policy the way he's talking about it, he will be in for a very rude surprise, you know, because for an average Brazilian or Indian or, you know, Kenyan, I mean, it's, you know, it's very nice that we are more multilateral in the UN Human Rights Commission. But what they really care about is America going to keep its market open? Is it going to continue this forward movement of an open world and open world economy that has allowed so many of these countries to move out of poverty? And if there's a sense in which we're becoming close-minded on that issue, that's a bread and butter issue for the world. I recognize that there are difficulties and dislocations that free trade causes, and that you have to address them. And we should be, in my view, we should be much, much more active on providing the kind of safety net that would allow us to compete in this world. I mean, I think being in a declining industry myself, that is print journalism, I've unfortunately had to lay off people over the last 7 years. And I'll tell you, many of these people are very intelligent. They understand the economics of what's happening, and they haven't, you know, fought the horrible rearguard actions. But they were all very concerned about healthcare. That was really the big concern they had, because, you know, these people understand that they have to repackage themselves and look around. But they've got kids, you know, and they're willing to take risks. They just don't want to take risks with their children's health. And I think that if we can somehow provide some kind of portable universal health, it would actually make it much easier for us to compete in this new world, because Americans are risk takers. Then we would be happy to kind of go forward into this world and take our chances.
Unfortunately, we've reached the point in our program when there is only time for one last question. Fareed, you told us earlier that we can't just believe what we hear on TV. But for those of us who, like you, seek better international coverage, we have some hope that beginning this Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time on CNN, on Global Public Square, there will be something we can listen to. Can you give us a sense of what we will find when we turn on the television to listen to more of you?
Sure. I mean, in a sense that the television program grows out of very much the same concerns that the book grows out of and that my columns try to address, which is to try to understand that there is a big world out there, that, you know, we are a very, very important part of it, but we are 5% of the world. And if you watch television news, you will notice that there is very little attention paid to the other 95% of humanity. And I've had people say to me, do you think you'll be able to fill an hour with the, you know? Yeah, you know, I mean, there is, as I say, the other 95% to talk about. And what I hope to be able to do is to try to make people understand that we really are in a world where, for the better and for the worse, we are much more connected. You know, look at what's happened with this recent financial crisis. If not for the great pools of money that existed outside the United States, in the Gulf states, in Singapore, in China, Citigroup would have gone bankrupt with all the cascading effects that would have had. Merrill Lynch would have gone bankrupt. 20 other banks would have probably gone bankrupt. And, you know, the fact that other people are doing well is a good thing. And if we look at the world that way and ask ourselves, what is the alternative? Do we want to live in a world in which people are in desperate poverty, spiraling downwards, politically unstable all over the world? Yeah, you have fascinating, difficult problems because of the rise of the rest, as I call it in my book. But fundamentally, we have to celebrate this. 3 billion people are in the process of escaping poverty. That's 3 billion more people who are eating, drinking, consuming, saving, investing, producing, thinking, dreaming. This has got to be a good thing for the world. And we have to look at it in that light and say to ourselves, we had some small part in making this work. And if we approach it that way, we'll be just fine as well. Thank you very much. Thank you.
To let our radio audience know, we have a standing ovation here.
Thank you.
Our thanks to Fareed Zakaria, editor of Newsweek International and author of The Post-American World. This program has been generously sponsored by Orrick Global Law Firm as part of our AHA series. We thank our audiences here and on the radio. I'm Liz Sherwood-Randall, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than a century of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.